It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Well, I'm at EcoFarm, and two of the stars of EcoFarm so far, as I'm concerned, are my guests today, and I'm going to let them introduce each other. I'm going to start with Tim LaSalle, and Tim moderated a keynote panel. And Tim, I'm going to have you introduce Ray, and then Ray, you get to introduce Tim.
Well, this is a great pleasure. You know, we did have a keynote panel last night with Gabe Brown from North Dakota, who's a star in basically being able to regenerate soils at levels people couldn't imagine. And we had Dr. David Johnson from New Mexico State University, who's breaking paradigms for us on understanding how soil functions actually work with the biology. But you're very privileged to have Ray Archuleta here with us today in your program, Roger, because Ray is really the soil guy in this country. He's one who's well known and well recognized across the country after 30-some years with the NRCS and actually learning all of those years about what makes healthy soil.
Let me stop you just quickly, though. When you do an acronym, what's NRCS stand for?
Sorry, good. National Resource Conservation Service from USDA. And with regard to that, he has gained great understanding into what true soil health means about aggregation and percolation and biology and nutrient cycling. And he is not only an expert in this, he's one of the most dynamic speakers we could find to teach us about what we really need to know about soil. So it's a great privilege to introduce Ray Archuleta.
So, Ray, I'm going to give you one thing as you respond to this. You can't start with aw shucks.
Yeah. What can you say to that? How about that?
Okay, yeah, that's fine.
Well, I've been very fortunate to know Tim. Tim, I met about, what, 5-6 years ago at the Rodale Institute, maybe that. But I've never seen anybody so passionate about caring about the planet and how the thing that makes Tim LaSalle a pretty amazing person is that he's trying to bring many worlds together to the organic world, the conventional world, the no-till world, and to bring these worlds together to kind of say, look, there's a lot of commonality that we have, and especially the soil, and how we can restore it with the least, how would you say, destructive forces or tools that we're using today. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that makes it very difficult is we have a group that thinks, well, in the organic group, they till a great amount, and when you hold them accountable while tillage is destructive, it becomes a very sensitive issue. And same thing with the no-tillers, you spray too much, that becomes a very incredible sensitive issue. But at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is promote regenerative ag. That means a system that is going and developing and bringing more life. And the way I like to say it is, I tell people, well, how's your marriage, Ray? And he says, it's sustainable. Well, if you use that word sustainable and you keep it in that context, well, it kind of sucks to have that kind of marriage. But if you think about it, well, my marriage is regenerative. And by the way, it is, because every time I wake up in the morning, I see a fantastic woman and I say, it's dynamic in life. And that's what we're trying to do is Tim and I and various group of us are saying, look, it's not either this way or this way. It's about emulating nature. That's what Tim and I really teach. We want to teach people how to emulate nature and how to be careful with their tools.
You know, what I like about both of you when I've heard you speak now is that you have this all-inclusive view, because I think there's a lot of people that say whether they're organic or sometimes of the conventional extreme, on either extreme, and they think there's no place in the middle, you know, and that you either have to be, a totally perfectionist, all in, one way or the other.
Right.
And what I really just love about what both of you I've heard say is that you're throwing a life raft out there. I mean, anybody can jump in the boat, and that there is a way for you to be connected, whether you've got 2,000 acres of corn and soybeans in central Illinois right now, or you've got 10 acres outside of Santa Cruz in an organic operation. Now, that must be kind of a challenge. Do you each find that you go places when you make that ecumenical kind of statement that some people are pushing back?
Oh, yeah.
sure, some people want to push back, but if we step back and look at what Ray is doing and what we're trying to do from the standpoint of talk about soil health, that applies to everybody. And then when we start to correlate and make people understand the fact that the only way to mitigate climate change, to draw down our excess carbon, is through soil, it affects everyone. So all we have to do is not get in little battles around some of the minute details or philosophies on both sides of this debate, but rather come to the core understandings of what biology wants to teach us, and let's make it a robustly healthy system, both atmospherically, productively in the soil, and improving our water cycles. And we should all be able to come together on that discussion.
Well, thanks, Tim. And Ray, I heard you get a question last night after your presentation where somebody was challenging a little bit because in the system you were describing, there needed to be a transition stage for larger scale agriculture that you couldn't necessarily, many of them couldn't necessarily get rid of herbicides. They may do a lot. Could you explain that? Because it was making somebody uncomfortable in the audience, and you had a good answer for them, I thought.
Yes, I think that people don't understand the scope, how large some of our farms have become. And society pushed the size of the farms. The government taught it. The extension taught it. NRCS taught it. Get bigger, get bigger, get bigger. It's the forces of cheap food. Too many people in the city, not enough people in the countryside growing the food. And so I say we have a human and animal distribution problem. All the animals aggregated in one spot. They're put in feedlots. We have actually
made... Say that again. Say that phrase again.
Okay. So here's the thing that I say. We have a human and animal distribution problem.
Yeah,
we have too many humans in the city. We have all our animals confined. They're in same ecoregions or areas, so we create water quality issues. We have lost in the respect of the natural system, not giving it space, and that we're part of that system. And so what we've done is we've aggregated our animals and plants, and we treat it like a machine, which led to poor nutrient food, disease, antibiotic resistance, farmers actually committing suicide because of the economic and financial stress. So I was trying to tell the lady, I said, ma'am, you don't understand how much it takes and how much risk a producer. These are multi-million dollars. And by the way, they're not all corporate farms. These are family farms that have accumulated over a period of time.
Right.
The pressure is intense. And you don't wean people off your chemicals overnight. Even basic things with human addiction, you work it slowly or the body goes into incredible stress. So you work it gradually. You just don't say, I can't farm without fungicides or insecticides and that. It doesn't work that way.
Well, now, Tim, you were around when getting started, when a lot of the push was taking place. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, you were connected with, were you Extension? Or research?
No, I was, first I was at university. I was at Cal Poly as a professor.
So you were getting started in those days when it said you got to get bigger, get out.
Absolutely. I mean, it was the Secretary of Agriculture, Earl Butts, that came through in that era and said, get bigger, get out. And our whole farm policies were established to create that. And what we started to lose, and Ray's talked about this, and I've seen it and talked about it, people have done documentaries on it. As we started to get big, we pushed our animals off our farm. Our rural communities started to die. Farms got big. Schools were losing their populations and closing. Businesses were closing. The rural communities were becoming unhealthy in so many ways, at least sociologically, as financially they imploded. The same thing happened biologically on the farm. We lost the diversity. We lost the rotations. We lost all of the biodiversity, even of the insects, the healthy predators versus the ones we seem to be so worried about. And so we can see these community dead zones in a way based upon our government policies. The work that Ray and Gabe Brown and all are doing now is really crucial to try and think in terms of how you bring the diversity back. Is there any way we can also bring sort of that economic diversity back too? And there are ways that we could think about that more complexly. And I know Ray and Gabe talk about that, and I would leave that in their corner.
Well, I can relate to that. Do we all come from a farm?
Yes.
I grew up in town, believe it or not. Okay. Both Gabe and I grew up in town.
Ah, okay. And then you came. Well, when I grew up on a farm in central Illinois, we did rotate everything. I mean, we had, you know, we did have corn and soybeans, but we also had oats and alfalfa, and we had a cow herd that we ran out there. We
had
a sheep flock, and we had a couple thousand hogs. Yeah. And every single bit of grain that we produced, everything we produced on the farm, went through an animal. Mm-hmm. And I spent every weekend cleaning barns. And part of the reason I'm not doing it today, it was not the most fun part of the job. But it seems like we've lost several decades of getting away from that. So, Ray, where did you enter the scene on this if you grew up in town? I mean, you didn't grow up in some town thinking, someday I'm going to dedicate my life to soil or anything like that.
Well, what happened is I worked on my uncle's ranch at 15. And my parents owned land, but we didn't have enough of nexus of land to be able to have our own farm. But I've been exposed to it since I was about a young kid, and I grew up in a really small town. But working at my uncle's ranch, I realized when I turned 15, I said, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be involved in agriculture. And I went to agriculture school, and I worked with an ag agency. And then through my years of 35 years, I bought my own farms. And so just a passion for it.
So let's talk about your own farm.
Yeah.
Then, so you started doing farming, and then you get to actually kind of walk the talk, not just talk it. And so what did you find? Were there any harsh realities as you were getting into it, like it's not as simple as you thought or anything like that?
Wow, that's a wonderful question, Roger. And I'm telling you, the night that I bought that farm, when the papers closed, I'm in there sitting with my wife. I said, look, I'm 56 years old. You don't want to get into debt. And here I am, 56 years old, bought a farm because exactly for what, if I'm teaching this, I better be doing it. I'm sitting there and I said, either this is going to be brilliant, start a school here, or I'm an idiot. And the jury's still out. But it's my passion.
Yeah.
So we were so committed. But back to your point, it is incredibly complex. I sat there that week and my wife and I talked about it. Farming and ranching is the most difficult profession on the planet. Rocket science is easy. You can predict that. You're dealing with a beautiful, elegant system that changes and works on chaos. Chaos means unpredictable. And the temperament that a person has to have to be able to manage all those things coming, he has to be a mechanic, an agronomist, an ecologist, a soil scientist. He has to be a carpenter. People don't understand how complex it is. And I have actually said to myself, my gosh, I might not even have the temperament for it. The patience.
Yeah.
And so it's incredibly difficult. I don't think people understand what's involved.
But Tim, you've been involved in teaching. I was trying to figure out the right word for it, but you've been working with farmers and people that want to be farmers. But you made that transition. I mean, you were at Cal Poly, and then you went to Rodale. Now, that's a pretty big step. I don't know what I'm leaving out in between. You go literally across the country and get involved with Rodale, which almost represents a very different point of view in many people's eyes anyway. That's quite a journey.
It was a journey because it wasn't one step. So while I was at Cal Poly, I also, like Ray, said, I'm teaching this, but I'm also going to do it. And I started my own dairy farm because I was in the dairy science department. So I had that for eight years. And then I was asked to take the California Agricultural Leadership Program over full time, which I ran for 17. That sent me all around the world, and I saw the degradation of what we were doing agriculturally. So I can't critically think and say, let's just keep teaching what we've always taught, because it's not really producing a future, it's producing an end. And with that, it challenged me. I eventually took over the Savory Institute for Holistic Management, really stopping the spread of deserts. I then moved to a nonprofit that worked with grassroots, because I wanted to learn grassroots leadership. And then was asked to apply
about
for
the people or the plants.
No, I'm talking about the people, but that's a good correlation. And then was asked to apply for Rodale. And eventually went to Africa also with Howard Buffett, combining both the organic systems with the no-till systems, and worrying about hunger and the smallholder farmer on that continent. So all of those have been gifts in an evolution and a long journey. And I remain humbled by what the earth wants to teach us if we can pay attention.
Yeah. Well, you know, that reminds me. I've talked to some people that have been involved with the Howard Buffett program before. And the interesting point they make is that when you look around the world, and the question always comes up, and you guys have both touched on this, is how are we going to feed the world? And they point out that in some of these small holdings, it's not that they are going to get 2,000 acres and $1 million combine, because you can take some place with 3 or 4 or 5 acres and they can still do agricultural practices that double their production. And so in much of the world, there's still some baby steps to take, really, really basic things.
Some very basic things. It's what Ray teaches. It's what we understand about soil and soil health and biology and no-tilling. And in essence, a demonstration research farm that Howard gave me was on very poor soils and increased yields 5 times from what the smallholder was doing. And the only input I bought was seed. So that took nothing from the outside, no fertilizer, nothing. It was a matter of rotating crops, using cover crops, and that's all it took to increase yield 5 times. So if you take farmers that are producing less than a ton per hectare, up to 5 tons per hectare, they now not only have food security, but they have cash in their pockets. And in Africa, as an example, the most food insecure are the rural people. So it's the right effort Howard was looking at trying to accomplish, and knowing that fertilizer wasn't the solution in Africa, because you had to build soil carbon as fast as you could. You had to build organic matter. And then secondarily, so much effort by the Gates Foundation, et cetera, was going down the wrong avenue. And at least the Buffett Foundation understood the right approach, working with a smallholder in a biologically healthy organic no-till system.
It's incredible, Ray, to see this work that's being done around the world. And I don't know, do you get outside of the U.S. too?
I've been invited all over the world. I served a couple of years in the Peace Corps in Central America. And see, that taught me is, and I get so frustrated when I hear politicians or people of high stature in these corporate industrial complex companies, and they say, well, we got to feed the world. And I said to them, no, we don't. We got to teach the people how to feed themselves, so they have the integrity to teach themselves and have the confidence that they want to be able to be self-reliant. They don't want to be reliant on other people. They want to have the dignity to do it themselves. So I get very frustrated when I hear that message, because the message does 2 things. One, it gives the producer, like here in the United States, that they're doing something very noble, that they're feeding the world. But actually, 40% of their crop goes to feeding animals and livestock and in feedlots. And then the other percentage goes to in the automobile. But in the reality, they're not making food for humans. And so we're degrading our soils, importing our nutrients to other parts of the world, and we're destroying our soils at the same time. And so the reality is we're not feeding anyone. The reality is, let's teach them soil health and ecology, and we can feed the world of 9 billion people easily. Easily.
You know, I feel guilty that I'm not kind of running out and getting into the battle somewhere. Well, although we're doing a podcast, so I'm going to be helping that way. But you guys are psyched up about feeding the world and changing food systems. You do it one day at a time, though. You know, and here you are. You're out speaking now. You're heading somewhere else. You're going to be speaking as well. How are we going to define success? I mean, if you look at the time that you're putting into this, what are you going to look at in a few years down the road and say, that's progress. I'm glad I had something to do with that.
Well, for me, I use the saying, one heart, one mind at a time. I think sometimes we think that government is going to solve our problem. Money's going to solve our problem. That's not how it's going to be fixed. I always remember the story of 12 fishermen and Christ changing the world. Martin King, what he's done for the South. And these people, it always started from the bottom and it worked the way up. We change the world with caring human beings. They have a passion. They have the same why. Tim and I have the same why. We love the people, love the land. We want to change it. And when you have people like that, I never believed that one person can make a difference. I was totally wrong. One person does make a difference. And there's a cumulative of us making a difference. It'll change the world.
Do you see somebody making progress and think, I'm happy to be a part of that?
I am just a humble servant. I realize I dropped the seed, but the good Lord waters it and makes it grow. So I'm just a seed planter. I dropped the seed. We don't know. I've taught so many times. I could be in a huge group and I'll sit. A 68-year-old man get it. And a 38-year-old man not get it.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
he sat there and heard the same message.
I've talked to a 100-year-old farmer that got it.
And he changed his whole operation.
Yeah.
It was beautiful.
Yo, Tim, I'm going to give you the same question, except that I'm also going to say you can't just say amen. Yeah, it'd be tempting. I mean, it'd be tempting.
But amen's a good word. You know, what I think is important in this conversation is that I think Ray and I both continue to look at this as service. And in essence, we are in service to the planet and to humanity, but it's also to all of life on this planet. And what we're finding is there are people really that are beginning to resonate and understand the importance of this work. And they'll pick it up. And Ray's in the business, and I'm kind of in the business of educating as many people as we can mm-hmm. to continue to be those disciples. Because Ray has pointed out, how many years ago was it, Ray, that if you looked up soil health on the internet?
If we looked up soil health, and I did this search about 12 years ago, there was maybe a couple of thousand hits, maybe 10 or 12. Now there's like, I Googled it, it was like 780 million hits just on the word soil health. It was like mind-boggling.
So this reinforces Ray's point. It's not the government that's going to fix this. It's a 790 million hits as people start to become aware of the need for soil health, for carbon sequestration to fix the climate, fix the water cycle, and produce more food. And for farmers, more profit, actually give them more financial security.
Well, let me just ask you another question now, and that is that people hearing this conversation, and say you're a farmer or a wannabe farmer, and you want to take that first step. I mean, what do you Google? What do you search? I mean, where do you go? I mean, so if somebody happens to be listening to this podcast or talking to someone and saying, I heard these guys, they had some interesting visions for, and I'd like to figure out how I can look into it more, or take that first step. What
Roger,
do you do?
I tell you, one of the biggest conduits for us for creating change has been YouTube. I cannot tell you how much young farmers do YouTube all the time. They study it. I had a young farmer, Adam Chappell from Arkansas. He watched Dave Brandt's, my videos, and Gabe Brown's. He converted 8,000 acres into no-till and covers by just watching YouTube. He was looking for some answers.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so YouTube is very powerful. Type lasagna garden. Type the word soil health principles. Gabe pops up. I pop up. A lot of people. It is a conduit, a media that's just changing the world. I've had people come up to me and say, Ray, a person from South Africa, they farm 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 acres. And the wife says to me, Ray, you've been in my bedroom. I go, whoa, I've never been to South Africa. No, my husband at 12 o'clock is watching your YouTube videos, and I'm listening and watching your face, and I'm going, oh, my gosh, you poor lady. But that's what I'm saying is go to YouTube. Type the word lasagna garden, no-till garden, soil health. Keywords, plethora of stuff comes up.
How about you, Tim?
Well, this is exactly right. The way we communicate and spread information today has changed, but it's also more rapid. And the internet can bring us a lot of negative, but boy, can it bring us some tremendous constructive positive, too. And this is one case where it could really contribute. For people who want to make a difference, they can start in their backyard. They can start by the kinds of foods they buy. If you're a farmer, you can begin to learn, as Ray says, go on YouTube to begin, take classes. At Chico State, we're starting to do more research in this for practical farmers. We're going to have demonstration sites up there as well. And the idea is, how can we disseminate the information as fast as we can around the planet? We find ourselves challenged by this climate. We're challenged by water in this state. We know that. And we know that farmers are often challenged and stressed by the financial conditions. And these are the things we want to affect as rapidly as we can.
Are there budgets around that people that want to see where's... actually, they have to make a bottom line. So they're making some change in their production practices. And they may be doing either changing a crop rotation or dealing with cover crops that aren't necessarily the short-term bottom-line impact. Are there ways that a farmer that wants to go this direction can find examples of budgets that work?
Absolutely. There's a PDF file. There was an NRCS study done on a young farmer named Russell Hedrick in North Carolina. They did a really good case study. This young man grew up in town. Mm-hmm. He was a fireman. And he left. He started with 40 acres. Now he farms 1,000 acres. That young man's going to be a millionaire. Last year, he won the yield contest for North Carolina, 318 bushel corn, dry land, non-GMO. This young man integrates all that. So they did a whole complete case study of the costs and all the analysis. that has been that information has been out for quite a while. Case in point, when a person goes from conventional to no-till, their fuel drops by 66% right off the top of the bat, instantaneous. Wear and tear and maintenance on the tractor and equipment happens right away. So there's great information out there that'll give you that kind of data.
Well, that's exciting. And are the land grants taking this challenge up? I mean, most of them now created something called sustainable something or other. They've got a sustainable program. Almost every land grant, I know Chico's not a land grant per se, but it's got a good agricultural program, as Cal Poly and others do as well. And there's extension service. There's extension in every county in the nation. Are they taking this challenge and helping do the education and the training?
I will, and I'll pass this to Tim. I'll tell you, it's spotty. It depends. I will be honest. The land grants have been our biggest resistance. Chico State and small universities have embraced it quicker, and they tend to embrace that information and the knowledge about that, and they've changed very quickly, and they've been a big blessing to us and a big help. Now, saying that, not all land grants are like that. It's a function of the person. Some in a small land grant university would embrace it, but he's occluded and treated. The rest of the professors might not see it that way.
Yeah.
So I think it depends.
Ray explained it well. I think it's a challenge if you're a professor in a land grant or in another agricultural university in this country, and you are going into a very regenerative focus. There's not a lot of support because the PhD training has compartmentalized you into a very specific research line, and it's not looking at whole systems. It doesn't understand how complex this is typically. It is perhaps stuck on an idea of input consciousness agriculture instead of the soil can provide it when it's healthy and alive. And this is a whole new paradigm change. It's why the work David Johnson's doing at New Mexico State is so paradigm changing that he's having trouble even getting some of his well-researched and well-reviewed work published in journals. And we're actually on a course of trying to create a journal of regenerative agriculture to make a place that's for these scientists to publish their peer-reviewed work, having the peers who understand the complexity of whole systems be the ones that are reading the papers. We need to change our paradigms. We've been doing it wrong for thousands of years, and we've been destroying our systems for thousands of years.
Well, those are some exciting ideas, because as we speak, no doubt there are hundreds of extension meetings going on around the United States at this moment that are, you know, training about some sort of production practices. And yet I've, just as you said, I've suspected the same thing. It was kind of spotty. And you see some doing a really, really committed to sustainability, and some you wonder whether it's just lip service yet, that they're not really backed up and don't necessarily have the budget or the extension backing. But hopefully it'll come.
It's true, Roger. And I don't want to bring Ray's marriage back into this discussion, but he
talked about
the sustainable versus a regenerative concept. And that's a word that I think we want to think about a little bit, because we've actually overshot the opportunity for sustainable anything.
Yeah.
We really only have one option, and that's to rebuild our systems. And soil's at the base of this, of what we have to rebuild. And that's why we're using the term regeneration. It's not just a fancy word. It is by intention. We need to, and we're learning how to build those systems and build inches of topsoil.
Well, you know what? You've brought us to a good spot to wrap up on. And the final area I want to get into is how consumers can relate to this. Because you're talking about something that most people could say, well, this is good for the earth, you know, that we can affect, climate change. We can affect, this just makes sense. We can feed more people getting this right sized. But to a consumer that says, okay, I get it. But is there any way that I can tell whether the food I'm purchasing is produced in a regenerative fashion? And they're even confused about the term, because they're promoted non-GMO, they're all sorts of organic, and lots of labels in the store right now. And now we're adding another one, is to think about regeneration. I mean, what's a consumer to do that's in favor of this direction and would like to support it, you know, with their purchases?
It's a really important question, and we're at the early stages of this. Now, Dan Kittredge's work talking about starting to measure nutrient density, we're quite confident because we've seen early research that as you improve soil health and you have a more biologically alive soil, your food's going to be healthier. And I think once we can start to measure that, it's going to make it pretty easy for consumers to make these choices.
To cut through all this, and I say the best thing to do, and Tim is right, the best thing for a person to do is know your own farmer, buy locally, because then you know the integrity of the person. I think the number one thing, no matter what, through all the spectrum, I know one thing that, Gabe keeps saying this all the time, the number one thing they ask, even before organic, is it non-GMO? It is a common thread question. Nobody wants their food genetically modified. They do not want it altered. They don't want antibiotics. They don't want anything. They want food. They want it to be their medicine. Mm-hmm. And right now, the American public needs to start educating themselves too. Case in point, if they would get to a point where they could tolerate a little more pockmarks in their apple, that means you could use way lot more less insecticides. People won't buy a piece of fruit if it's got one little besmirchment on it. I want the fruit that's got those little marks because then I know if the insects are in there, it may be nutrient dense. The problem is we as Americans need to be more educated. And so the more you want something that looks totally pristine, which is not reality, you're going to use more insecticides, more chemicals to keep it that way.
Yeah.
So they got to educate themselves.
You know, one thing I might push back a little bit, Ray, is that from my experience, I've sat into some focus groups too, and some people, well, many people, have concerns about GMO and so forth. But one thing I've found is that if a farmer can explain what they're doing and they've got good reasons, they usually give them the benefit of the doubt. And so, and the thing that I like to see is that what they want to see is authentic, honest farming that has an explanation for what their farm system. And that goes back to the first point you made in this conversation too, or one of the first points, was talking to the person that they may have to use some herbicides. And there are those that think, well, I want to be totally out of it entirely. But once you explain, they say, well, okay, I get that. But they want to be sure that they're hearing the honest fact.
Absolutely, and that's hard to get at. And that's why I was telling to you, is farmers don't want to pay for that extra material also. When you buy genetically modified seed, you're paying more like $100 a bag for that particular seed. So it's economics. And so people need to understand that. But I do give people, the farmers, the benefit of that. I don't get into the argument with that, but I will tell you, why spend it when I don't need it? Healthy soils don't need all that.
This, I think, is also often the way we want our food grown. We want it grown more locally. We want it grown where there's an attention kind of to the diversity that's needed and therefore the health of the whole system. So some of that's coming, but it's slow.
Well, I'll tell you what, you both are helping along, and we're really fortunate, I think, to have you out on the road. Maybe you'd like to be less out on the road, but out taking this story around, and I want to thank you both for being on Farm to Table Talk today.
Thank you very much, Roger.
Thank you, Roger.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.